My name is Jennifer Weiss. I am a pediatric orthopedic surgeon. I work in Los Angeles with Kaiser Permanente, and I'm also a fellow of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. I'm joined today by my colleague and friend, Dr. Amy Ladd.
Hi, I'm Amy Ladd, and I'm an orthopedic hand surgeon at Stanford University Medical Center, and I'm also a fellow of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons.
I'm excited because today we are going to talk about a topic which is definitely timely, and we are very fortunate to have a real expert with us to talk about appropriate workplace behavior, and specifically appropriate workplace behavior in the orthopedic practice setting. Earlier this year, we met Ms. Karen Michael, Esquire, who gave a presentation at one of our AAOS meetings, and it was entitled Blurred Lines, What is Workplace Behavior? Karen, would you mind telling us a little bit about your background and expertise on defining appropriate workplace behavior?
Sure. So I'm an employment lawyer of 25 years, and I came out of law school, worked at a big law firm for about 6 years, was the director of employee relations at SunTrust Bank for 9 years, taught at University of Richmond School of Continuing Studies in the graduate and undergraduate programs, and have had my own HR and employment law firm for the last 10 years, where all I do is workplace investigations and training and employment law advice. I don't do any litigation. And what that means is I get to go into just lots of different industries and get my finger on the pulse of what's really going on in workplaces and understanding how these behaviors have originated, what's appropriate, what isn't appropriate, and really trying to help workplaces resolve these problems. And so that's kind of the expertise that I bring. I also write a weekly labor law column for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and I've done that for about 5 years.
Thanks, Karen. And we heard you at the spring NOLC meeting, the National Orthopedic Leadership Conference, and it was a really compelling symposium. People stopped what they were doing and listening. So let's go over some of these definitions. Can you define what appropriate or inappropriate workplace behavior for our listeners is?
What I would say is there's two kinds of inappropriate behaviors. One is inappropriate behavior that the law would say is inappropriate behavior. And the other, I would say, is inappropriate behavior that maybe isn't illegal, but is still wrong. The type of behavior that is illegal is behavior or conduct that would implicate one of the protected characteristics under federal employment discrimination laws. And those include any kind of behaviors based on race, color, religion, age, disability, sex, national origin, genetic predisposition, pregnancy, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, veteran status. Any inappropriate behavior that implicates those things, those characteristics, would be illegal if it meets the hostile work environment definition, which we'll talk about. The second type is what I would say isn't illegal, but is completely inappropriate, which is workplace bullying, which doesn't fall into these federal employment discrimination laws, but still creates an extremely hostile and inappropriate work environment.
So you talked about protected characteristics, and that's the type of groups that are susceptible for sure. My understanding is that state laws differ than federal laws. So what's the loophole there? Which is more dominant?
You know, in California, there are a whole host of laws, employment laws, that California is a little bit unique from most states. Many states have separate state laws that might implicate some additional characteristics, protected characteristics like marital status. I think DC has one on appearance. So I had a case, for example, of a woman that claimed that she was discriminated against because she was overweight and unattractive. And so she filed a charge. So different states have some different types of behaviors that might be protected. But in general, you know, federal law is really where most cases fall, other than I would say California, where frankly, there is a very large host of high dollar, high verdict cases that come out of that state, falling under the Fair Housing Law, which is really where the employment characteristics come in for California.
Great. So what might be some of the protections protected individuals have? What are their recourses?
Employees that work in any workplace that has more than 15 employees, other than age, which is 20 or more employees, have a right to come to work and not be in a hostile work environment or suffer quid pro quo harassment. And that means they get to come to work and not be subjected to those behaviors by anybody, coworkers, management, third parties that come onto the premises. So for example, in the medical field, employees should not be subjected to that by patients, by third parties, by contractors. Nobody should be subjecting our employees to that type of behavior. They have a right to come to work and be free from that. An example I had recently in a medical practice was one of the women that worked in the administrative staff claimed that a patient was upset with his bill or something to that effect and called her the N-word. And the physician said, I can't fire this patient. This patient's very sick. I can't just fire the patient. But I don't have any proof that this person actually said this to my employee. So, you know, do I really have to do anything? And I said, of course you have to do something. At a minimum, you send that patient a letter that says, my employee believes you have behaved disrespectfully. You can never engage in that behavior again. And if you do, you're not going to be able to keep coming to our practice. You have to do something to stop the behavior. So all employees are entitled to come to work and be free from either that type of hostile working environment or quid pro quo, which is this for that. Something to the effect, there was a case that just came out the other day where an employee of a Subway franchise, a manager, was offering a woman a job, 17-year-old woman a job, and he said to her, quote, bang my brains out and the job is yours, in a text message. She didn't engage in that sexual favor. She didn't get the job. That's quid pro quo. So those are the protections that employees have when they go to work.
I'm still reeling from the text message. That's incredibly...
It's shocking.
Incredibly shocking.
Well, in this day and age, you could say it's just incredibly shocking. I mean, it's just hard to imagine that a 17-year-old young woman is looking for a job in a Subway restaurant, just needs a job, and this is the kind of nonsense she has to deal with. And the concern and the fear and the frustration, this has to stop.
And the lack of common sense in terms of documenting it in a text message is another mind-blowing aspect. It has... honestly, I've been in my practice for 15 years. It has never occurred to me that I actually had a legal right to not being bullied or harassed by my patients. You gave a great example as to what that physician should have done in that scenario with the patient speaking to the employee in that way. What rights does an employed physician have? So In the scenario that you brought up, that was a physician that ran the practice or was in private practice, I think. Many of us today are either employed by a hospital or a large medical group. As physicians, if we are the recipient of that sort of behavior and we are not the ultimate decision maker in our practice, what is the recourse or suggestion for that sort of a scenario?
This is where the breakdowns have occurred in most organizations, because people like you potentially and people in many industries feel like, you know what? I've got to sit around and take it. This is just how it is. I was at a restaurant with some of my daughter's softball parents, and one of the men fathers says something to the wait staff, hey, something, honey, darling, sweetie, something inappropriate. And I said, that's not appropriate to speak to her like that. And I asked her about it. And she said, you know, people come in here and drink, they're drinking. It's just kind of what I bought into when I came to work here. No, it isn't. And no, it isn't to a physician. You have an employer, and that employer is, if it is, the hospital. And whenever you are subjected to behavior that is inappropriate, sexual, violates any of the policies of your hospital, and certainly if it violates the employment laws, and a manager is put on notice that behavior has occurred. Now, that can happen in several ways. The manager can overhear it, or the employee, the physician who might not be a manager, would tell somebody either in human resources, whatever the process is. You might have a hotline that you call. And once that employer is on notice that this behavior has occurred, whether it's through a complaint or not, it's not a complaint-based system, it's a notice-based system. Once that employer is on notice, it has an affirmative duty to take action to end that misconduct, whoever is causing that misconduct. And there's not like they've got lots of time to do it. They have to immediately stop that behavior. And whoever the employer is the entity that has that obligation.
Karen, you mentioned greater than 15 employees. So what if the setting is 4 or 5 employees? What is the law?
We're looking at the total number of employees, but typically there are state laws that might kick in. For example, Virginia has a law that kicks in between 5 and 14 employees. So typically that would go back to a state law. And many states have a variety of much smaller laws that would apply to much smaller organizations. There are also some state laws that kind of go along the same lines. For example, there's the intentional infliction of emotional distress, assault and battery if you've been inappropriately touched. There might be some laws, state laws, that could be implicated that don't fall into the federal employment discrimination arena. So there could still be some recourse, although there might be not as a formalized recourse as there is under the federal discrimination laws.
So if you were in a small setting and there were like 5 to 7 employees, then you'd have to pretty scrappy about how you would approach this, is my guess.
The problem I have is that we should not be stopping behavior just because it's illegal and we might get in trouble legally. It's a culture issue. And if you're in charge of a practice or running a practice and an employee's in an environment where that employee is not able to be fully engaged and successful because nonsense is going on, why wouldn't the employer make every effort to stop that behavior? I tell people, let's get away from lawsuits and focus on culture. What culture are we going to tolerate here? What do we want? We want our employees to be fully successful and fully engaged. It's kind of like my son plays college football and he's got all these people around him, trainers and tutors and counselors that work with them for one purpose. They want when they get on the field, they want them to be game ready. And that's what I would say about these small practices. Don't you want your employees game ready and not focused on all this other nonsense that's happening to them? Have a position in your organization, whether it's 2 people or 2,000 people. We are not going to tolerate any of this nonsense towards our employees. We care about them too much and our work is too important. We are going to stop it if it happens, regardless of whether people can sue.
So in the culture and the environment of medicine in general, and we're talking about orthopedics, but I say medicine in general, I heard recently about a young lady who was being interviewed for medical school, and she was asked the question, would you ever date a patient? And if not, what if this person, this man, had a lot of money? And I was appalled by that, and the fact that it was a one-on-one interview, and that it was allowed, or perceived to be allowed, or perceived to be okay. So what do you think of questions like that, and how can we as leaders change that kind of culture?
That question is a ridiculous and outrageous question. The question should be to every applicant, do you understand your ethical obligation regarding inappropriate relationships with patients? What would you do if you were approached by a patient? If that's part of the question you're asking everybody, men, women, if that's important to your organization, you're certainly entitled to ask whether that person understands those obligations, because that's an important point, I'm sure, of being a physician. But these questions that we tailor to specific people, I like to use the example of this. Well, first of all, let's be clear. Everybody comes to work with an inherent bias. These efforts to try and remove bias from people is tough because we have life experiences that we can't take away life experiences. So I use this example. I say you're interviewing a candidate and he says he's a 45-year-old candidate and you ask him how many kids he has, which you shouldn't be asking. And he says, I have 6 kids. And you're thinking, man, that guy needs a job. You ask a woman, how many kids do you have? She says, I have 6 kids. And I tell the group, don't you lie to me. What are you thinking? And they all say she's never going to come to work. She doesn't have time for a job. Because people have life experiences and inherent biases, good, bad, or ugly. Don't ask the question in the first place that could implicate your inherent bias. Ask job-related questions that are relevant to the job. Don't ask, tell me about yourself. Ask, why do you want to work here? Why did you become a physician? What about practicing medicine do you like best? Whatever those questions are. Ask questions that are intended. Don't ask, you know, how many kids do you have? Say, this job is going to require you to be on call 24/7. Is that going to be okay? Are you going to be able to accomplish that? To everybody, not just men or women. We have too many inherent biases. We think, oh, I can let that out of my mind. You can't. Once it's in there, you can't take it away. I was working with a construction practice, and they are having a horrible time hiring women. And I had 203 leaders in this room. 202 of them were men, and they can't figure out why they can't hire women. So I asked this case study that we do interactive technology with, and I said, you're working on a big project. It's going to take 3 years. This woman tells you that she was recently married. Why are you talking about that? You believe that she's going to have children probably soon. And so you don't hire her, and you assume it's a legitimate non-discriminatory reason because you need somebody who's going to be there and you're worried she's going to have kids. So you go for the man that's a little less qualified, but you know he's going to be there. Is this legal? 90% of the people in the room said, yes, that's legal. They actually think it's legal to deny a person employment because you think she's going to have kids in 3 years because the project's a 3-year project. See, these are inherent biases that we can't get away from. And because of that, we've got to park those kinds of questions and inquiries and focus only on the requirements for this position. Even the behavior-based ones, like tell me about a time you didn't get along with the patient and how did you respond? Tell me about a time that your patient didn't follow your expectations. What did you do? You know, you can ask those questions, but ask them of everybody and don't tailor them to men, women, different races, different religions. Don't do that because that's where the illegality comes into play.
Come to the table with inherent biases. Do our best to put those aside and ask questions that you will ask of everybody rather than elicit specific things that might bring out your biases. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and recognize when you have an inherent bias because we have life experiences. There was a case where one of the big quarterback football players, a woman was asking a question during an interview, and he looks at her and he says, wow, it's so weird to hear a woman talking about routes. I mean, it's funny. He had in his life experience was he wasn't used to women talking about routes. The fact that he's not used to that, there's nothing wrong with that. It's okay that he has that thought in his head, but don't articulate that or act upon that. Those are where we have problems in the workplace.
Karen, I have two follow-up questions to that. I'm intrigued by the situation in which there are many people interviewing and somebody else in the process either asks an inappropriate question or comes across information that is not relevant. For instance, everybody has interviewed the person and somebody comes up with information that they bring to the table to say, oh, I have found out that this person is pregnant, let's say. And what do we do if we're part of that conversation? Are we able to, once that situation has happened, is there any going back?
Yes. So first of all, I'm not a big fan of panel interviews at all. That's where like this stuff bubbles up. People on these panel interviews, it's just a weird environment. I know people do them. I'm not a fan of them. I've had too many investigations into these panel interviews where they have just gone south and they develop their own culture and it's just not great. So just start with that. I'm not a big fan of panel interviews. But I have been asked that question frequently of what if the guy down there asks a stupid question and now the person answers it and now we're all stuck with it. I think we need to all stack hands before any interview process and say, look, this is how this is going to go down. We are going to make sure it is a real process. We're going to prepare for it. We're going to ask legitimate questions. And if anybody asks a question that they think I've said something inappropriate or if I think you have, we're going to call you out in the interview on the spot. Say, oh, wait, that wasn't on our list of questions. Just stop it right there. Don't allow it to perpetuate. We have to kind of all stack hands and agree. This stuff has to stop. And I'm going to hold you accountable, and I want you to hold me accountable. Now, once it comes out, like let's say the person volunteers, oh, I'm pregnant. My answer to that is, why are you telling us that? Because I want to know. Maybe they want to know about benefits. Maybe they want to know if you're going to discriminate. Who knows? But if the person volunteers that information, I always say, why are you telling me that? Because I do want to know kind of where are we going with this? And then I stop it right there. My point is just stop it right there and then end the interview and then go talk to HR on how best to respond from there. The same is true, by the way, if somebody discloses a disability. So it is illegal in an interview to ask any disability-related questions. It's just literally like the asking of the question is illegal. It doesn't matter if you rely upon the information or not. The mere asking of the question is illegal. And that's not true with these other characteristics, but it is with disability. But the two exceptions are that if the employee volunteers that he or she has a disability, or the disability is obvious. You're hiring for an orthopedic surgeon and the person is clearly blind. That would raise the inquiry of the specter of inquiry. Even in those situations, I say, don't ask any disability-related questions because there's limitations on what you can ask. You can't say, how long have you had this, or what's really wrong with you, or how bad is it? Can't ask any of that stuff. So limit it. Go. I don't think people use their HR resources enough, and I don't think organizations train their HR resources enough so that, because they need to be the expert. You're the expert at what you do. You shouldn't have to know all this stuff. You need to have HR resources on hand to help you when these situations come up. And then that person can follow up with an inquiry.
Well, on the more subtle questions, so when, you know, someone has a wedding ring, or they volunteer that they're recently married, or that they have a toddler around, how does that fall? Because they're volunteering, not the wedding ring, that would be an inquisitive type thing, would be an invasive question. But if they said, you know, my husband and I, or so are you allowed to pull out from that?
No. You're allowed, so to speak, but why would you? In some ways, you're like, I'm trying to get to know the person. I want to know the person. That's great, but you are, whatever your hidden bias is going to kick in. Maybe your bias is in favor of people with kids. Maybe your bias is against people with kids. Whatever that is, it just, nothing benefits from that. If the person says, I have a toddler, for me to then say, oh, really? I have three kids. Tell me about you're veering off into a world that is not relevant to whether this person can perform the essential functions of this job and whether the person's going to be a good fit. If having children is a prerequisite to the job, then put that on the job description. But if that's not relevant to the job, let's not go there. If the person brings it up, just redirect.
Let's talk about social media. Dr. Weiss is an expert and I am not. So I want to hear your thoughts on what is the extension of the workplace. Can the work, if people are active on social media, does that by definition expand what the workplace is?
So there's private sector and there's public sector. So there is a difference in how that's treated in the law. So let's start with the private sector. So in the private sector, there's this law called the National Labor Relations Act. Even if you are not a union environment, the law still applies to all private workplaces. And there's this provision of there that says employees, it's what we call the Section 7 provision. And it says employees can engage in mutual aid and protection. So they could engage in conversations to kind of talk about the workplace. So if and this doesn't apply to supervisors, by the way, only non-supervisory employees. So if a non-supervisory employee goes out and says, my workplace is disgusting, it's unsafe, it's unsanitary, I'm not paid well, whatever, my boss is a jerk, and other employees join in, so it's not my personal issue, it's other employees are joining in, that employee actually might have a protection from being terminated or disciplined because of that discussion, because they're talking about the workplace, albeit in a very public forum, and employees are joining in. That's a very narrow exception. But in general, I tell people, if what you do out there impacts your ability to work in here, you can't work here anymore. So you better make that worthwhile. You look at Roseanne Barr. She tweeted what many thought was a very racist tweet. The government cannot come and arrest Roseanne Barr for that tweet because she has a First Amendment right to that speech. Her employer, ABC News, is a private organization. The First Amendment has nothing to do with that organization. And what ABC News said is what you did out there impacted your ability to work in here. You can't work here anymore. And they had every legal right to do that. People need to understand that once I post something out there, I don't care if you say it doesn't represent my employer or not. Once it gets legs and somebody sees it and they start tracking down your employer and bothering your employer, most of these people don't get to work there anymore. And I've seen, I have multiple examples. There was a case of a woman who they're in the maternity ward, and they were holding up these little babies dancing with them in this video. One woman stuck her middle finger up and posted, "How I feel about these little heathens," or something like that. This is what people are posting online. Why are we ruining our careers for that reason? Now, in the public sector, let's say I work for a public hospital or a university or something, the test is this. You, in theory, have a First Amendment right, but it's not unfettered. The question is, are you speaking on a matter of public concern or private interest? The second thing is, number one, am I speaking on a matter of private concern? Number two is, am I speaking on a private concern or public interest? And do the rights of my rights outweigh your right, my right to speak on a matter of public concern and our matter of public interest outweigh your right as an employer to run your business smoothly? So if what I'm posting creates hate, disharmony, those kinds of things, most courts say the employer does have a right to take action against that person. So your right to, quote, post inappropriate things is not unfettered, even if you work for a public sector organization. So people who assume I have a right to say anything I want, the First Amendment's going to protect me, that's just not how it works. So these people that post all this nonsense, just know it could impact your ability to continue working in your work environment.
So when people make comments, post whatever on Facebook that is perhaps unrelated to work, but somehow impacts the environment of their work, is that susceptible?
Even if it doesn't impact the environment of their work, Roseanne Barr didn't impact the environment of her work. She was just posting something racist. And they thought, you're a despicable person, and now you can't work here. We don't want somebody like you working here. There were these people that went to the rally in Charlottesville, and people were posting them saying they should not be able to work at their employers anymore because they obviously are racist, and people got fired as a result of that. So it's like, I don't know that people fully understand that you, in this day and age, what you do out there really could impact your ability to work in certain work environments, because employers have codes of conduct and codes of ethics. And it's just, that's the world we live in with social media, that you could be impacted depending on what you post and what you say, even if it's unrelated to the job. There was this woman that posted after Duke University came out with their enrollment statistics. She just was online one night and posted, wow, when I went there, I didn't see a white male in the bunch. It looked like the UN. Somebody saw that post and said, where does this woman work? She's racist. Yada, yada, yada. She's no longer connected with her employer as a real estate agent because of that post, which was totally unrelated to her job.
So just to clarify, when you mentioned about Charlottesville, so who got fired? The ones that called the people who were rallying? Who got fired and who was the perpetrator?
So people at the rally, there was a website called Yes, You're a Racist. It's a Twitter site. And they went in and zeroed in on every single person at the rally and said, do you know this person? Do you know this person? Do you know this person? And there was a guy, I think his name is Cole, I forgot his last name. And he worked at a place called Top Dog in California. And this just by one way of one example. And the public, once they found out who he was, trolled that restaurant until he got fired. And the company posted, he's no longer working here. And they even had something that says, we've been inundated with information. I mean, there was a guy that worked at Nordstrom's, and he posted something about police. And he said, the next time a white officer kills a black man, they should kill that officer's family on his doorstep in front of his family. Yada, yada, yada. Somebody saw that post, realized he worked at Nordstrom's, contacted Nordstrom's. Nordstrom's fired him. Somebody tweeted at North. They said, we don't tolerate workplace violence or any violence. Somebody tweeted at Nordstrom and said, wow, I'm going to take all my presents back that I bought from Nordstrom's. Doesn't this guy have a First Amendment right? And they said, thank you for the feedback. They can't have him working there. How does this guy get to keep working there now that they know this information?
Fascinating. I would love to circle back to probably something a little bit less fiery, or maybe it's more fiery, I don't know. And that is kind of the nuances of the maybe less exciting, more mundane, quote unquote, hostile work environments. You started off explaining to us, I think, what the difference between a hostile work environment is versus an actually illegal work environment. And I believe that many of us as women in orthopedics perhaps as underrepresented minority physicians in orthopedics and medicine are really experiencing these nuances that may or may not be considered hostile work environments. Can you help me to better understand the definition and where these crossovers happen? And then I would love to talk about some tips and tricks about how to mitigate inappropriate hostile work environment behavior, or even just inappropriate behavior that may not be considered hostile.
So let's define what a hostile environment is as it relates to the law. The law defines two types of hostile working environments, legally actionable hostile working environments. One is what we call coworker harassment. That's behavior either between two coworkers, non-supervisory, or between a third party, like a patient that comes in and harasses, or a vendor or somebody that harasses your employees. And the test for that is this. The employee says, I belong to a protected group. Well, everybody belongs to a protected group. We're all either male, female, or we identify as such. We all have a national origin. We all have a race. Everybody belongs to a protected group. The employee has to say, I was subjected to this behavior because I'm a woman, I'm a man, I'm black, I'm white, whatever it is. And a reasonable person would find the behavior offensive. And I found that behavior offensive. And the harassment was severe or pervasive, so bad that it impacted my ability to work in terms and conditions of my employment. And my employer knew or should have known that this was going on and did not do anything to stop it. If the employee can show all of those things, then the burden shifts to the employer to say, we didn't know about it, we knew about it and stopped it. Those are the kinds of things that the employer would have to say, or it wasn't really hostile, it wasn't that bad. That's a legally actionable hostile working environment. The supervisor one has the same initial cause of action, but on the notice issue, the employer has to show where an employee claims that a supervisor engaged in harassment of any form, race, gender, national origin, whatever. The employer's defense is that it took reasonable steps to prevent and then stop managers from engaging in harassment, and the employee didn't take advantage of all the corrective measures that we have within the organization to complain or tell somebody. And that is why it is so critical to train your managers, because they actually have an affirmative duty under the law, A, to be prevented, and B, to report. So let's get back to the situation you described, which is kind of more mundane. Somebody calls you honey, sweetie, baby. Somebody makes a sexual joke, offhand remark, something like that. What I tell employers is this: do not wait until something escalates to the point of being pervasive and severe before you stop the behavior. We have got to, what I call, sweat the small stuff. These little things, these jokes, these innuendos, these inappropriate text messages, whatever they are, that seem insignificant at the time, grow to be big things. And what I tell people is, don't make a deposit in somebody else's bank, because one day that person might decide to make a withdrawal. A coworker of yours might say something inappropriate one day, make an offhand remark, make an innuendo. Well, those things add up. And every day I'm saying that, I'm making a deposit in your bank. And one day you might have had enough. And who knows whether the court's going to determine that the totality of that behavior is severe or pervasive. So that's why we have to sweat the small stuff. These little things that seem insignificant rise up, and employers need to take action on the small stuff and not wait for them. And in fact, that's what happened to in California. A case just settled in that case for $2.3 million. The athletic director in that case, it was against California State University. And the athletic director initially was making stupid remarks to women saying, you know, honey, sweetie, baby, called one woman legs, which this assistant athletic director, who was a former Olympian, complained to HR, and they're like, oh, you know, it's a term of endearment, it's no big deal. But that behavior grew, yada, yada, yada. Now, $2.3 million settlement. So we've got these little things. If somebody is offended and a reasonable person would find that offensive, let's stop it. Let's not allow it to continue.
That is empowering, to say the least, to have that language. That's great.
Well, I have a list of things that we call the never, ever list, that you should tell employees you can never, ever, ever do these certain things. And the list is not that long. It's not like you can never, ever do anything, but it's anything sexual. Even if everybody's laughing and joking, even if everybody is giggling, even if no one is offended, you cannot allow any sexual comments at work. I tell people no one needs to know what you're getting, where you're getting it, how often you're getting it, who you're getting it from, how you like it, where you like it, when you like it. And you shouldn't be talking about other people's sex lives. All that stuff needs to be off the table. Even if it's with your best friend at work, let's just take that off the table. And if we do, we're never going to have a sexual harassment problem at work. Little touchings that people have with coworkers, take that off the table. Hugging, kissing somebody on the cheek, massaging somebody's back. I did this training and this guy, and we talk about touching and all that. And at the very end, he said, I did a video and it prompted him to say, you know, my secretary and I worked together a long time and we work late nights and she massages my back and I massage hers. I'm starting to think that's not a good idea. But it took like 2 hours of training for him to get there because everyone thinks it doesn't apply to them. Everyone thinks my situation's different. My situation's unique. You don't understand the relationship I have with my people. Nobody is off limits. Everyone should just play in that same space. And then we never have to worry about a sexual harassment problem in the workplace.
So, you know, my question was specifically, as a manager or physician leader, what are our obligations to protect others from being subjected to inappropriate work place behaviors, but I'm going to extend that. So in this, you know, kind of the killjoy, the party pooper, oh, this is our environment, stop saying that. You're saying we absolutely have to. When someone starts a joke, we have to say, stop. I mean, how do we do this without being the killjoy all the time?
Well, you set that expectation in the front end. The key for all these organizations, and some organizations are getting there. I mean, I sometimes travel around the entire country for certain organizations. They want to train every single manager on the same message and say, we are serious about this. So the first test is, have we gotten serious? If your organization has a policy that hasn't been updated in 22 years, and you do computer-based training where people click, 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 you're not serious about changing behaviors. You're a compliance-based system, not a culture-based system. We need to set that standard. And let's say you say, well, Karen, I'm a practice manager. I don't have the authority of this big hospital to do this training. You set your own expectation of your own people and say, look, we got to get serious. We cannot be an environment where nonsense is happening. And I want you to know that you have my commitment. And I'm not going to tolerate any nonsense. I'm not going to tolerate racial jokes or inappropriate statements. I'm not going to tolerate the N-word. I'm not going to tolerate sexual innuendo, inappropriate comments about religion, race, national origin, all of that. And if I hear about it, you need to know I'm going to take action to stop it. So whether everybody else in the hospital doesn't play in that space, you tell your staff, if this happens to you by anybody in this hospital, I want to know about it because I'm going to stop it. If at least control your own span of control. I had this guy come up to me after training and he said, look, I work with a bunch of older women that have been with the company forever. I'm younger, but I'm their boss. And he said, they hug me every morning. They call me honey, sweetie, darling. I don't know what to say. I don't want to be that guy who, you know, comes in and all mean. And I said, you just need to go back to your department, call a meeting and say, look, I just went to this training and we got to tighten up around here. We have to be more professional. So these are the things going forward we're not going to do anymore. It's not personal to anybody in this room. It's just we've got to be run like a business. We've got to get more serious about professionalism. And hopefully after this, we can still have a great working relationship. But these are the things that are off the table. And you just lay it out there. And then you hold people accountable.
So let's talk about bystanders. You know, when you observe behavior and you're not necessarily part of it or the recipient, what is our role? And let's say we're not even leaders at this point. We're just observing.
If you're not a leader, you're not a manager, you don't have any management responsibilities, technically under the law, you don't have any responsibilities. Morally, we are never, ever going to end harassment in the workplace until people stand up for each other and hold each other accountable. The EEOC says that, I don't know, like 80% of the people who are harassed at work, they don't complain, they just quit. I love when organizations say, well, we don't have a problem here because there's no complaints. Most people don't want to make waves. They don't want to say anything. They don't want to be a troublemaker. They don't want to be retaliated against. And many people think they will be. So who are we going to get to come forward and help to make sure the environment stops? There was, you know, that Matt Lauer case, the NBC case. It was an interesting case because NBC came out and said, oh, in 20 years, we've never had a complaint of harassment against Matt Lauer. But yet there was a video that surfaced that showed him saying to Katie Couric years ago, something like, pretty sweater, keep bending over like that. It's a nice view. You don't think all these other people heard that? Well, maybe Katie Couric wasn't offended. She doesn't care. She's not going to complain. but other people heard that, and you don't think that happened over and over and over again, somebody should have done something to stop that behavior, whether you're in management or not. We can't, but we have too many environments where people are afraid to come forward. They think if they come forward, they're going to be retaliated against. They're going to be the one in trouble. That is a major culture shift that we need to make in organizations. And it starts with leadership. Leadership sets that expectation and that commitment. If you come forward, you will not be retaliated against. We will take action to stop the behavior.
Do you have any examples or stories of, you know, we are an organization of orthopedic surgeons. Do you have any examples or stories of a organization or culture that you have seen shift or switch for the better for us to hope for?
Absolutely. 100% I have seen organizations switch for the better. And unfortunately, sometimes it takes them going to the bottom of the barrel to rise up. But it's just examples of organizations that will say, Karen, I want you to travel the country, which I do for a lot of organizations, and I want you to train every single one of our managers. And with me, traveling is a leader. So it's not just Karen Michael coming in there. It's a leader introducing me and saying, we've brought Karen in here, and what she's telling you is our expectation. And I, as your leader, am telling you what she's saying we cannot tolerate. I'm telling you, I'm not going to tolerate. And at the end of that training, that leader stands up and said, did you hear what she just told you? We're not kidding. So this is going to be how it's going to be going forward. When you combine that kind of outside person, at least, because then they feel like at least they're not internally making it up, with leadership and accountability, that is just an amazing change in an organization. But I tell people, you can't just stop today. There's a great example of a woman who worked at San Diego State University. She was a dean, and she observed all this horrible behavior by Bob Filner, who was the former mayor. And she was interviewed about that and why she didn't do something to stop it. And she said, you know, we write these policies, we think our job is done. Our job is not done. And that's what I tell people at the end of training. Your job is not done. 2 months from now, 6 months from now, 8 months from now, renew your commitment with your staff, with yourself. What am I going to do to make sure that we continue with maintaining high expectations of accountability and professionalism? Because it does, you fall off the wagon. You got to get back on a regular basis. You can't have Karen come out every 6 months. We've got to make sure we internally are keeping that alive so that we are having those regular discussions. Policies cannot be words on a page. They have to live and breathe. And it's a great experience for a leader every month. Call people in for 10 minutes and say, let's talk about section 2B of our code of conduct and what that means to us. All right, today we're going to talk about no retaliation in our policy and what that means to us. If you did that 12 times a year, your employees know you mean business. Like, we act, this matters. This isn't just words on a page. This matters. And this is how we're discussing how it matters. That's how we change culture a little bit at a time. And eventually, it's just how it is around there. This is just how it is when you come here. We have high expectations of accountability and professionalism.
It is an incredible empowerment to know that I now have you as a resource to refer people to if they are in that bad place in their practice. So for that alone, I'm so grateful. And all of the tools and tips and tricks that you've shared with us, just overwhelmingly awesome. Amy, do you have anything to add as we start to wrap up here?
Yeah, I've taken a few notes, and I would say the three things that I walk away with are that it's up to us to raise the bar, to set and articulate expectations and reinforce them, and then exercise the muscle of good behavior. And with the continual reinforcement and renewal as opposed to a one-off. Anything you want to add to that for take home?
I think a very important part is that you don't have any double standards. Too often people think this is a female problem in the workplace. Well, first of all, many women commit sexual harassment. In fact, my article coming out next week is about a woman pharmacist who made people kiss her on the lips, allegedly, before they could get their paychecks. So don't assume this is just a male problem. This is a workplace issue. Women can commit harassment just like men. The second thing I want to mention is I just give this example. I was doing a training and a guy came up to me after the training and said, well, you know, I was in a meeting with a bunch of male lawyers and there was a woman in there and we were talking about the settlement of some product liability, some medicine that was the equivalent of Viagra and it settled because the drug didn't do what it was supposed to do or something. And he said one of the men in the group made an offhand joke, an inappropriate sexual joke, and he turned to the woman and said, I'm sorry. He realized he shouldn't have said that. And I said to the guy, my problem with what you just told me is that he turned to the woman and said, I'm sorry. It's not about the woman. It's about the behavior at work. It doesn't matter if it's all men, all women, it doesn't matter. We cannot tolerate this behavior, period. The problem is you were only sorry because there was a woman. It wouldn't have been okay if he said it to all men. That is the only way we're going to eradicate harassment at work is if we don't tolerate, regardless of who is around us. It just has to be in our psyche. We aren't going to act like this at work with each other, period, end of story. No double standards. That is how we're going to eradicate harassment.
That is an amazing point that really applies so much to our 94% male field. Unless, Karen, are there any other points that we haven't drawn out or asked you about that you think we're missing for orthopedists, for everybody who might be listening to us today?
I would just do 2 points. The first is culture. Too many organizations say, oh, Karen, it's our culture. It's, you know, do you understand the medical field, the construction field, this industry, that industry, surgeons, that's how they act, blah, blah, blah. We have to get away from that. Just because we've been doing that for years and years and years doesn't mean it's right. And it, whatever your industry is, I don't care. The Title VII doesn't divvy up industries behavior based on industry. Inappropriate behavior is not okay whether you're in a bank or whether you're in a surgery room. Inappropriate behavior goes across industry lines. The second point I want to make is about touching. Too often we become really familiar with people in the workplace. And of course, you're going to touch people with consent as it relates to your practice and your patients, but as it relates to each other. And so often this issue of hugging comes up in the workplace. And I did this training for like 300 people. And I use this interactive technology. And at the end of this training, this guy stands up and it was all employees, not managers. And he says, ma'am, you're trying to change our culture. We love each other. We hug each other. Nobody's offended. Everybody is happy. We all love each other. And this person in the way back of the room said, hey, Miss Michael, do one of those voting slides on whether we like to be hugged at work. So I, on the fly, did a voting slide and it said, I like to be hugged at work, yes or no. 89% of the people in the room said no. And I said to the guy, I said, we're in a room of 300 people. 33% of the people said they wanted to be hugged. Show me right now who those people are. He said, well, I have no idea who those people are. I said, that's my point. You like to be hugged. It makes you feel good to hug other people. But the majority of people in this room don't want you to touch them. So just because it feels good to us, we assume it's consensual and that other people want that same thing. That's probably not the case. So this touching issue, I think, just perpetuates the overly familiar nature sometimes of our work environment that can lead to claims of harassment and inappropriate behavior.
That is such a great down-to-earth tip that I'm going to bring back to my workplace for sure right away.
Well, and women are the most guilty of hugging each other. So, you know, this is not a man-woman thing. It's just in general in the workplace.
I like that hashtag women are more to blame for hugging one another. That's great.
Yeah, start it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I am just so thrilled that we were able to do this. I know that you gave such an amazing presentation to a few orthopedists, but to be able to bring your knowledge to our greater organization and to others that are not orthopedists as well is just so valuable. So I want to thank you so much for your time today. And any other comments from either of you before we wrap this up?
No, thank you for having me. Anything we can do to improve the workplace is a good thing. Believe me, we've got to get serious. Everyone deserves to come to work and be safe.
Thank you so much, Karen. I really appreciate it for raising the bar and raising our awareness. And it will be a continual education for all of us. Thank you so much.
Yes. All right. And with that, I will say thanks to everyone for listening to us. And if you liked this podcast, please share it and leave a review on iTunes, and look forward to more AAOS podcasts in the future.